Welcome to the Oral History Review at the Oxford University Press blog. Occasionally, we like to break up the monotony of text posts with a podcast, celebrate the oral and oral history, so to speak. With these podcasts, we hope to give the Oral History Review's authors and editors a place to elaborate on or build upon their scholarship. Furthermore, as with all of our social media efforts, we aim to build awareness of the art and craft of oral history. The following podcast is hosted by Troy Reeves, the Oral History Review's managing editor and head of the Oral History Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Enjoy.
Thanks, Caitlin. Today I'm talking with and listening to Ken Woodard. Ken wrote a piece in the most recent Oral History Review, Volume 40, Issue 2, entitled The Digital Revolution and Pre-Collegiate Oral History, Meditations on the Challenge of Teaching Oral History in the Digital Age. Ken's piece describes his experiences teaching oral history-based audio and video documentary techniques to high school students, including assessing the opportunities and challenges of doing such work in the digital age. Woodard is chair of the Upper School History Department at Stone Ridge School of the Sacred Heart in Bethesda, Maryland.
All right, well, thanks, Ken, for agreeing to talk with me today. I appreciate it. The first question is, what knowledge of oral history did you have before you started working with your students?
Prior knowledge of oral history before working with my students was at best minimal. I had encountered the concept of oral history in graduate school in the course of doing some historiographic work and kind of learning about the various disciplines of history. And I was aware, of course, of its existence, but knew very little about its ethos or its professional standards. My journey to oral history proceeded from my interest in video documentaries. I did 2 years of video documentaries with students, envisioning myself as a high school classroom Ken Burns. What came to light with that is within the time frame we had and the resources at hand, and even with the support of technology from a cable access station near us, that the whole thing had a superficiality to it that was hard to watch. We arrived at a topic, Vietnam veteran nurses, and it occurred to me in Washington, D.C. area in, I think, 2002, were probably lots of veteran nurses, and so it occurred to me the responsible thing to do would be to talk to some of them about this topic. A colleague of mine mentioned Glenn Whitman, author of Dialogue with the Past. I called Glenn Whitman. He's a proselytizer, and so he essentially gave me the rough draft to his book, his yet-to-be-published book. My journey to actual understanding of the practice of oral history was very much contingent on my attempt to apply it right away to a documentary project. And fortunately for me, Glenn Whitman had boiled it down already to such a practical extent that it was, I think, possible for me to proceed with some of the basics in hand. I've learned a lot about oral history subsequently, and I think the next step for me was then participating in oral history conferences and meeting oral historians. It's such a community-oriented discipline, appropriately enough, for oral history, and I've been continually amazed by the extent to which high school history teachers are welcomed into that community with relatively open arms, you know, and accorded, I think, as much respect as full professors seem to get. I doubt that's the case in other disciplines, even subdisciplines of history. And so I think the openness of the oral history community has been an incredible augmentation to my introduction to it through Glenn Whitman's book.
Ken, are there additional topics or items that you wanted to incorporate into the article?
Actually, there is one item that I regret not elaborating more on in the article. And in the article, I wrote in a very general sense about collaboration and the extent to which collaboration is essential for success in projects of these complexity and ambitions. And I failed to discuss how at my current place of employment, that collaboration has been the lifeblood of continued evolution for me as both an oral historian and someone doing post-oral history production. So my colleague Sharon Kenny in the history department has done an amazing job of accepting the oral history torch, and in the face of very understandable anxieties about the scope and breadth of the project, embracing it and really inflecting it with her own emphasis and particular contributions to how we now do that project here at Stone Ridge. And she, in turn, is now the main passer of the torch to yet a third colleague, Marlon McKinney, who we've hired. When she's returning to high school history teaching after a long hiatus and is now confronted as a U.S. history teacher with this oral history project, and precisely because of our collaborative dynamic here in the department and Sharon Kenny's leadership in that regard, we're able to actually, with some expectation of success, pass the oral history project on to other teachers who in turn will then go on to the audio documentary. And so I wish I had been more specific about my own experience with collaboration and its importance to the school and to the success of the students here where I work. And that is something I think that would have borne some more detail and discussion. And in considering that piece and what could be added to it or what maybe I didn't elaborate on as much as it might have merited, I thought about, I think, the question of posterity. I'm much impressed by oral history's emphasis on leaving a record for posterity. Then, in other words, the oral history circle does not close until the project is made available to the public for the greater edification of people beyond just the student, the teacher, or any oral history organization, but this idea that the oral historian and the interviewee are collaborating to create a valuable primary document. And I think that that ideal will have ongoing relevance in a world where media and innovation cycles get so tight that at times I think permanence will be threatened. And so if I could add to that article, include some discussion of the extent to which oral history offers us a roadmap to respect for posterity and the importance of preserving things for it and not just producing the next viral video for the next 3 weeks.
My next question is, if you could summarize your piece, what would you like educators and others to glean from it?
That's a great question. I can answer that in a number of ways, one of which proceeds from actually a worry about the whole thing. Sometimes I'm concerned about the reproducibility of what I'm doing, that the road I've traveled to get to the point where students are producing documentaries and using local resources is windy and twisty enough that it's not necessarily reasonable to assume that everybody, given their teaching circumstances, their loads, the exigencies of getting students ready for national tests, it's not always obvious that that's something people can do. And so I guess my message to educators, the thing I would hope they could get from this, is it's really worth the effort, that the number of doors oral history and production thereof opens are amazing. So if I could say that differently, I would say that the practice of oral history in the sense of collecting it and recording it and then doing creative things with it by way of production really opens a lot of interesting doors. You meet incredible people. It connects you with a community of scholars who, as I've noted, are really affirming. And it gets me even to places where, for example, I got to write an article for a national publication, which wouldn't have happened in the normal course of teaching from a textbook. And so I think for those reasons and many others, I guess I just really say it's worth the effort. And that brings us back to the collaborative emphasis, because the students buy into it, and it at times pushes them to extraordinary effort in their interactions with their interviewees. The interviewees are part of it. And so I think in that sense, it's really progressive and modern, that heavy emphasis on collaboration.
The next question is something that I've thought about and read about, and I think you touch on it in your article, but I wonder if you could comment on the disconnect that some adults, and I'll include myself in this, that think that students are both adept and innate consumers and producers of digital content.
Yes, I'm astounded at times by the extent to which students are passive consumers of digital media and how very few of them are active creators of it. And I think part of the origin of this perception that they are natural goes back to that phrase digital natives that I think was coined by Mark Prensky in an article that actually an educational technologist at my previous job had us all read, and I remember kind of bridling at the time at the notion. And the tone of those early articles and the coinage of the idea of digital natives was that they're already there, they're in this new paradigm thriving, and it's on us to catch up and accommodate, or we will fail them as students. And that is not how my experience has been, that any time that I assume they'll figure things out or be able to plan any kind of production. So, for example, in the article, I refer to their audio documentary script planning. Without guidance, without a lot of fairly rigorous and thoughtful guidance, the level they naturally arrive at tends to be low, and it's not their fault. It's just that, as with writing or any other worthy academic endeavor, it requires hard work to get to a point where you're doing anything remotely competent. And so the standards to which I hold the students and the amount of effort I invest in supporting them and achieving those standards has evolved considerably over the last several years, where before I just said, yeah, you know, pull some cuts from your one-hour interview, the best moments, introduce them with some comments, record your voice, edit them in, and it will probably be good. And that just ended up not being the case. The students, their natural instinct is to insert huge long cuts that are just mind-numbingly long, and they often commit unpardonable redundancy. They'll say something, and then their interviewee will say it. And you realize that, as with many things that professionals do well, professionals, for example, like the people at NPR that are doing this on a daily basis, they make it look a lot easier than it is. And so to address that, I have them listen to NPR interviewers. For example, Terry Gross in Fresh Air is a master. And then I have them pay very particular attention to how good radio is edited to keep the listener engaged. And as with video documentaries, a lot of what that boils down to are carefully considered shortcuts strung together in a meaningful way that tells a story. And again, that is harder to do well than you might think. And so I find that for each of those steps, the students really need and respond well to careful instruction, and that any time I take their ability to do any of that for granted, it generally doesn't go very well.
Second to last question. Since you've written the article, do you have any current oral history-related projects or any envisioned future projects in the hopper?
Well, that's a great question. I'm really excited. This year, I'm teaching a senior elective for the first time in several years called History Documentary, the basis for which will be some oral history of artists who did some artwork in Vietnam, in-country, much of it around 1968. We found boxes of photographs of amazing art in national archives, art that I've never seen anywhere else, and I don't understand why, because this stuff is incredible. You know, it's not just crude sketches by people in the field, but apparently real artists with rank and military status who used a variety of media to render these amazing images, and some of them tough to look at, of what they were seeing in Vietnam during the war. And on the back of each of these photographs, they've stamped the subject of the picture, the artist's name, and the year that the photograph was taken, presumably soon after the art was rendered. And so we hope to find some of the artists. We hope that they will live close enough for us to interview them and that they will consent to interviews. The fallback plan will be that I will document our quest to find these artists, and that in itself may end up being the story. But it's just this amazing trove of dramatic and in some cases beautiful, in other cases disturbing imagery that has the double merit of being public domain because it was generated by the military, and also just being highly visual and therefore suggestive of or appropriate for a video documentary. So I'm really excited about that. And then I always have to think at least a year in advance. And so I think for next year's project, I'm interested in, there's a mural of African-American history at a metro station, the Georgia Petworth stop on the Red Line. And it's done in the 1930s-like style, and it's a very narrative, episodic portrayal of African-American history from, I think, colonial times right up to the present. And there again, you have an amazing visual. And so if we can get permission to go in and videotape it, shoot it, take pictures of it, and then find some interviewees with experiences relevant to some of the things portrayed in it, that could be a very dramatic documentary. I'm just constantly scanning for topics that have a few basic characteristics. There has to be a large supply of public domain images associated with the topic. Most of them we get from either the Martin Luther King Library in downtown Washington or from National Archives to a college park. There has to be a pool of interviewees willing to talk about the topic, and so it can't be something too far in the past. And then the third thing is just that it's something around, you know, that's researchable by high school students within the constraints of a typical school year. And so always looking for that.
Always try to leave the narrator with the last word. So is there anything else you'd like to add?
I guess as a last word, I would reiterate the advantages of just rolling your sleeves up and engaging with use of oral history, marrying it to available digital technology for the incredible production opportunities that now affords for both creating media and then distributing it. I think that this offers unparalleled opportunities to break the teacher-student back-to-teacher loop and make really good, creative, and in some cases, moving work available to a broader public that will be quite receptive to that. I hope that will be the case.
Ken, I want to thank you personally and professionally for allowing us to link out to the videos in the article. It really helps our multimedia initiative.
Great.
So, Ken Woodard, I want to thank you for your time you gave me today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity.